funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the summer of 1964 change the course of American history? Before the Mississippi Summer Project brought together volunteers from all over the country to facilitate voter registration, just 6% of the state's black population was signed up to exercise its right to vote. The massive effort by multiple organizations to change that put both local and out-of-town volunteers at serious risk, but it succeeded in both securing a large-scale voter registration among African Americans and in focusing national spotlight on the racial injustice that plagued the Deep South. Historian Bruce Watson is the author of the 2010 book Freedom Summer that inspired the new American Experience documentary of the same name. Freedom Summer airs June 24th on KERA Channel 13 television. Bruce, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me.
A major point made early on in the film is that people in Mississippi just wanted to vote. They were not as involved in like boycotting bus routes and lunch counters as people in other parts of the South. They simply wanted to be allowed to exercise their rights to cast a ballot. Can you talk about the kinds of roadblocks that were placed in their way before 1964?
Well, ever since about the 1890s, there had been a concerted effort in Mississippi, and across the South, but it was stronger in Mississippi, to stop blacks from voting. And the ways it was done was, number one, the poll tax, which you had to pay even if you were not registered. If you wanted to be eligible to be registered at any point, you had to keep paying your poll tax every so often. And so a few dollars, but that was a lot of money for a sharecropper, just on the off chance that they might be registered. But then when you went down to the courthouse, I got the courage to go down to the courthouse and register. It was fairly simple to fill out the form, but then you came to a question which asked you to interpret any section of the Mississippi Constitution, any section that the registrar chose. It was extremely legalistic, very difficult for anyone to interpret, and it was entirely up to the registrar whether you passed or not. If you did pass, or sometimes even if you didn't, your name was put in the paper. And so just that you had tried to register. And so often there was a much more brutal retaliation. You might have your home fired into at night by a shotgun. You might have your credit cut off, your business cut off. So it was an extremely effective way of discouraging voting.
And there was even intimidation to the extent that people were told, your boss, your white employer wouldn't like to know that you're registering to vote. Why don't you just go on home and I won't say anything?
Right, that's exactly, and so that type of really under the keeping blacks under the thumb of the entire white power structure was prevalent, and it started with voting.
Was Mississippi different even from other parts of the Deep South?
It was different in that it was called the closed society. It was a term coined by an old Miss history professor in that age. It was some of the similar things might have been found elsewhere in the rural South, in rural Georgia and rural Alabama. But the thing about Mississippi was it was almost entirely rural. Jackson was the largest city, 120,000. There were a couple others. So most of Mississippi was much more difficult for blacks to vote in or do anything because of this strong rural character. And so, as you mentioned, only 6% of blacks could vote in 1964. That was way smaller, much, much smaller than elsewhere in the South, where it might be 30 or 40, or in Atlanta, maybe even higher percent.
And part of the concern, I suppose, among the white power structure was that there was a black majority in the state of Mississippi.
There wasn't quite a black majority statewide. There had been, at the turn of the century, but a massive migration to the north had changed that. But there were many, many counties in Mississippi where there was a black majority.
So therefore, if most of those voters were able to vote, obviously the political power structure would change.
Which have changed entirely. And the people of the White Citizens Council of Mississippi, the group of businessmen and merchants, often said, we recognize very clearly this is a power situation. And one man said, we'd be very stupid indeed if we surrendered this power.
All right, talk about that Citizens Council. I was really interested to learn that there was a presence by the KKK in Mississippi, but it didn't need to be as large as in other states because the Citizens Council sort of achieved the same ends.
Well, there was a large Klan presence, but by the mid-60s, but it hadn't been as strong earlier, especially in the 20s, not just because of the Citizens Council, but just because of some of the other Jim Crow laws that we talked about, the Citizens Council started in Mississippi. They soon spread to the whole South, but they started in Mississippi. They were labeled unofficially the Uptown Klan. It was a very accurate term because it was not the type of folks you would normally find in the Klan, in that it was, as I said, businessmen, merchants, very possibly a mayor or politicians, and they worked behind the scenes with no violence, really. Perhaps they condoned it, but they didn't initiate it, to block integration at every turn. Their major weapon was a printing press, and they turned out thousands and thousands of pages of pro-segregation articles and brochures and pamphlets, and they often spread disinformation and rumors about who was supporting integration and who wasn't. So it was a very well-organized group.
And they also exerted pressure on whatever minority of white Mississippians might have agreed that their black neighbors deserved equal protection under the law.
Yes, there was a small, very small cadre by 1964 of Mississippi, you would call them moderates, moderate maybe by other standards, but moderate by Mississippi standards, including some people who ran newspapers, occasionally someone with a little more power than that, and they were not run out of town, but they were sure made to suffer for anything that they wrote on behalf of integration. Their papers might be boycotted or any number of other political and economic pressures were put on them.
So before the Mississippi Summer Project came to the state, talk a little bit about local activism and what was taking place from within the African-American community that lived in Mississippi full-time.
Well, it started in Mississippi later than elsewhere in several years after the Montgomery bus boycott of 55. They didn't start organizing in Mississippi until around 1961. That was when a man named Bob Moses from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which we can call SNCC, I hope, came to Mississippi, started walking around, talking to blacks about their right to vote, and he really began to organize from a very grassroots level. He was the opposite of Martin Luther King, and all of SNCC was proud to be that. They respected King, but they chose a grassroots effort where you would get people involved in their own decision to go to vote. And Moses took people to the courthouse. He was often beaten bloody. He and SNCC filed lawsuits against Mississippi counties and elsewhere to uphold the 15th Amendment, and slowly, very slowly, they built small movements, first in southern Mississippi, and then when they were driven out of there by violence, up in the Mississippi Delta, getting people to come by and march and talk and discuss freedom, and then go down on so-called Freedom Days to the courthouse to register to vote.
Moses was a fascinating character. A high school teacher in New York City didn't visit the South until the early 60s?
No, he went to, yes, you're right. He taught at a private high school in New York. He'd been a graduate of liberal arts college in New York and was working on a doctorate at Harvard. And he had to leave that, and he went to Atlanta to work for Martin Luther King for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. But he was offered a chance to go to Mississippi just on his own. Black man going to Mississippi on his own to organize. That took a lot of courage, and he went on his own, met with some people there who had done some preliminary work, and from there the whole movement grew.
So how did the idea for the Freedom Summer come about?
Well, it was mostly Bob Moses' idea. It had been floated, they had, in the fall of 63, the election that was just before the assassination of John F. Kennedy, some different people had gotten an idea to help work on an election and call it a freedom election. And they nominated their own candidates. They voted for their own candidates in their own ballot stations, which were mostly things like barbershops and hair salons and things like that. And they held their own parallel election, which was symbolic entirely. There was a lot of violence suppressing it. But from that idea, and of course no one was elected. No, it was not legitimate, but it showed the opposite of what everyone, the white power structure in Mississippi and elsewhere, had said. They always said that blacks don't want to vote. Well, they got some 80,000 votes. So the idea was to do it again for the whole summer, bring as many people as they could, upwards of 1,000 volunteers, Moses said, not just to registered voters, but to teach in what they called freedom schools. And from there, the whole thing grew.
How were students recruited from all over the country to be part of this project?
SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, was truly masterful at public relations. They really knew how to reach out to the media. They advertised in the New York Times for funds and for volunteers. They sent a group of freedom singers around to campuses, and they sent people like Bob Moses and others around to campuses, Stanford, Harvard, Yale, Oberlin, Berkeley, speaking about what was going on in Mississippi, about the serious violation of voting rights. And they simply appealed to the idealism of a young generation, particularly after the death of Kennedy, who, had, of course, had started the Peace Corps. And they proposed to them to spend a summer in Mississippi, risk whatever violence might be, but to really work with, reach out, and bridge the gap that had long existed between Mississippi and the rest of the country.
It seems those students coming in from the outside didn't imagine anyone would be killed, but they were aware that there were serious physical risks.
Oh, yes. There were. You have to remember that although one of the things that Moses and others SNCC people said was, nobody's paying much attention to Mississippi. It's sort of, well, that's a southern problem, that's a Mississippi problem, they've always been that way. And they thought that Freedom Summer would bring attention, bring the nation's attention, and it did. But the volunteers knew there might be violence. They had seen the previous spring, there had been the police dogs and the fire hoses in Birmingham, and they'd seen Medgar Evers gunned down in Mississippi in June of 63, and there had been riots at Ole Miss in 62. So they knew a fair amount of violence might happen. They just didn't necessarily think it might happen to them.
Hmm. And there were some black volunteers who assumed that if they were traveling with white colleagues that there would be some protection afforded by that.
Well, they might. They didn't assume that for long.
Right.
They did think that perhaps it might not be as dangerous for them because they weren't from Mississippi. But one of the great signals throughout the summer in Mississippi, one of the great signals of who the volunteers were, was any car that went down any road with black and white faces in it, because that just didn't happen in Mississippi. So they were instantly spotted as they call it. Mississippians called them as invaders, as riders, as traitors, sometimes communists they were called. They were easy to pick out.
How did the state of Mississippi sort of prepare for the arrival of these volunteers?
Well, although Moses Bob Moses and SNCC tried to downplay any danger, tried to say, we're not here to protest, we're not going to be sitting in, we're just going to be running schools and registering people, Mississippi was truly panicked. This was an echo of Reconstruction from 100 years earlier when carpetbaggers and others had come from the north into the south to meddle and do other things, as it was seen through Mississippi eyes. So this looked like their worst nightmare. Mississippi prepared by the Jackson police, stockpiled all sorts of weapons. They bought an armored car. There were numerous towns that had neighborhood watches, phone numbers, preparing for any type of violence. And, of course, the Klan geared up into full battle mode and began burning crosses across Mississippi and preparing for what they called the communist, and they used the N-word, invasion of Mississippi.
Hmm. My guest is historian Bruce Watson, author of the 2010 book Freedom Summer, which inspired the new American Experience documentary of the same name, which airs June 24th on KERA Channel 13 television. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
They took a old school bus and gutted it out and made a mobile dentist and doctor's office. And we would go to the plantations where we would get people to come off the plantation for the doctor to examine them, help them with their dental problems. And also we could teach them how to register and vote on that bus. The Freedom Summer was the beginning of the fight for the right to vote. And if you look at all of the people who spent long, long, painful days and nights in the nasty jails in the South, people who got their heads beat in, you know, ate a lot of tear gas. States like Mississippi and Alabama and Louisiana, North and South Carolina, Texas. These states are still fighting against the right to vote. 50 years later, it's painful because I have some friends in the graveyard for the right to vote. This came with funerals. Yeah.
That was the Reverend Peter Johnson, who as a 19-year-old civil rights worker helped to register black voters during the Freedom Summer of 1964. That cut comes from KERA's The Voices of Freedom Summer series. This hour, we're speaking with historian Bruce Watson, author of the 2010 book Freedom Summer, which inspired the American Experience documentary Freedom Summer, which airs June 24th on KERA Channel 13 television. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So, Bruce, listening to the Reverend Johnson, it's interesting. He talks about mobile doctor and dental clinics being set up. Obviously, you know, people had a reason to get on those buses and get medical care, and also then could be instructed on how to go register to vote. It sounds that suggests that maybe there was some convincing involved, that it was worth the effort. People wanted to vote, and yet there was so much risk involved.
Well, that was one of the struggles throughout the summer and one of the frustrations for many volunteers, because they accepted the fact that voting was necessary, as I guess did everybody, but that didn't necessarily mean you wanted to risk your life or your business for it. And an awful lot of time was spent in Freedom Summer, especially the first 6 or 7 weeks, going door to door, shack to shack, sometimes out in the cotton fields, talking to people, convincing them to just come down and just come down to the courthouse on Freedom Day, next Wednesday or whenever, and just come down and just try to sign up. And there was a lot of resistance because people would say, well, no, I can't mess with that mess, or I'm all my children have. I can't take that risk. And you can't blame them. The outside chance that you might get to vote or register to vote was very, very risky when you consider the consequences of simply going down to the courthouse.
How influential in convincing people to go down to the courthouse were local Mississippi residents like Fannie Lou Hamer?
Well, if you were a local, you certainly had more clout. You could say, as Fannie Lou Hamer could say, look, I risked my job. I lost my job. She was a timekeeper on a plantation. And when she registered to vote, in 1962, her boss told her, we're not ready for that in Mississippi. You're going to have to leave. And she left, and her house, where she stayed, was shot into, and she was beaten and all sorts of other things. So she certainly had as much credentials as anybody for saying, you too should take this risk. But still, it was really just a matter of numbers. The way they actually got people to the courthouses in lines that stretched out around the block, simply a question of numbers. They wore them down. The 600-700 people out there canvassing, maybe not quite that many, speaking to 100 people a day, if you just get 1 or 2%, you get a line, and that's how they did it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Ellis in Dallas. Hello, Ellis.
Hi. Pleasure hearing from you. I was a volunteer lawyer. At that time, I was an assistant corporation counsel in New York. I volunteered part of my vacation to go down to Mississippi. I was assigned to Macomb, which is in southern Mississippi, and I befriended a white family, the Hefners.
Oh.
They were trying to moderate some opinion. They were Episcopalian, and their pastor was told by his, who was also sympathetic, was told to take his vacation. Hefner, the Hefners were, well, they're, I saw violence. There was one of the locals, part of the power structure, would ride around in a baby blue Cadillac and fire into the Freedom School. I defended they were a restaurant owner, owned a small luncheonette type, and they would serve, it was a black family, and they would serve Freedom Riders. And because of that, they were arrested and they had their license, at stake. I finally negotiated a deal with the local judge. They held court at 7 in the morning in front of a gas station. They had a table set up, and young judge, and paid a fine of $115. He could keep his license to serve beer. Anyway, when I returned to New York later on, I got a call from Red Hefner that they were running him out of town. What to do? I was in New York. He was in Mississippi. The only thing I could do, I called the New York Post and had a reporter call down to the chief of police down in Macomb. And apparently, the fear of publicity, widespread national publicity, put the damper on anything that the local White Citizens Council would do to Hefner.
Well, Ellis, thank you so much for your call. And Bruce, I know that many in Mississippi were concerned about all the outside attention that was suddenly focused on them.
Yes, it was one of the great successes, ironically, in Mississippi. Red Hefner, by the way, was run out not just of Macomb. He and his family, very, very loyal Mississippians who were not really even moderate. They just wanted to talk to the volunteers, were run out of Mississippi altogether. They wound up living the rest of their lives elsewhere. But the publicity was a major factor. It was not, SNCC didn't want it for violence. They just wanted attention for to show people what was going on in Mississippi. But when the three men, Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney, were turned up missing on the first night of Freedom Summer, and then their bodies were not found for several weeks, the entire nation turned its attention to Mississippi, and everything that happened all summer made attention.
And how did members of SNCC find out that those disappearances had occurred? Was it within hours, right, after they didn't turn up, that everyone in the organization was aware?
Yeah, they had set up an elaborate phone tree throughout the state of Mississippi, what they used to call a WATS line, a free long-distance service for a certain price. And every Freedom Summer base had a phone tree, and you were always supposed to, if you were in a car and you went out to any area that might be dangerous, you were supposed to call and check in. And on the hour, and Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney, I should say Andrew Goodman, a volunteer from New York, and Michael Schwerner, a Corps volunteer, also from New York, and James Cheney, a young black man from Mississippi, had gone out into Neshoba County to investigate a church burning, and they were supposed to be back that Sunday at 4, and they didn't show up. And they didn't call. And quickly, the SNCC phone tree and the COFO phone tree wound up calling, and they tried to call the FBI to find out what might be going on. They called sheriff's offices. Nobody had seen the men. So by 8 o'clock, everybody who knew about it was quite panicked, including people in Ohio who were training to go down for the next group of volunteers.
And it's remarkable that many people fully understood at this point the risks and decided to either stay or to go down as planned.
Yes, I think that's the true story of Freedom Summer. It's too often been told as a murder story or a crime story. But when this disappearance happened, the next morning, Bob Moses went before a group in Ohio, 250 volunteers headed for Mississippi within a week, and he told them quite clearly, three of our people have been disappeared in Mississippi. And he suggested, as he always did, you don't have to go down. You don't have to take this risk. And you would think that there would be numbers of people who would say, well, maybe not. Maybe it's too risky. But one or two did. The rest went through their training in just shock, got on the buses and went to Mississippi. So the way that the spirit upheld and overcame the violence and threat of violence is the true story, I think, of this entire summer.
We have an email here from Rick in Fort Worth that refers back to Ellis's call a few minutes ago. Rick says, I'd like to ask about the role of out-of-state attorney volunteers during Mississippi Freedom Summer. I know the National Lawyers Guild sent attorneys, and perhaps other groups did, too. What did they do?
Well, I wish Ellis was still with us, but they there were many groups of attorneys. It was decided early on, even in 1961, that along with the protests, along with the registration, there had to be a legal challenge to what Mississippi was doing. It was fairly easy to file these cases because it was so blatant, the violation of voting rights. There was no Voting Rights Act yet. That didn't come along till later. But there were civil rights laws that Mississippi was in clear violation of, most obviously the 15th Amendment to the Constitution. And so every time they could document any type of unfair denial of voting, the lawyers helped file lawsuits. Now, this made a change in, unfortunately, at that time, only one county. In Panola County in central Mississippi, they had filed a lawsuit. It had been overturned. They appealed, and the New Orleans Appeals Court ruled in favor. They put an injunction on the county, Panola County, and that summer, some 700 or 800 blacks were registered in Panola because of the injunction. But elsewhere, the lawsuits were just overturned routinely and didn't have that big an effect.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Eddie on the line in Dallas. Hi, Eddie.
Hi. Wonderful show. Thank you so much for the show today. Two quick questions. So I would like to get your take on how the press covers civil rights then versus now and how that's changed. I mean, one of the things, when you talk to a lot of really senior retired journalists, the highlight of their journalistic life was covering the civil rights movement. But my view is you don't have that same kind of coverage of social justice movements today, largely because reporters are a lot more affluent, by and large, now than they were then. I think there's a class dynamic there. But I'd like your take on that. And then the other thing I'd like your take on is what do you make of the fact that Philadelphia, Mississippi, which the only other, I guess, designation or significance it had was the three civil rights students that you talked about being killed there, but that's where Ronald Reagan decided to declare his reelection campaign in 1984. So I'll shut up and listen.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Two questions. Let's see. First of all, I think there is certainly a difference in the way civil rights is covered now. I don't know about the class distinction. I've been a newspaper reporter, and we didn't get that well paid. But other than that, I can't speak for the New York Times or elsewhere. Clearly, there's a distinction. I think one of the reasons, in addition to class, might be that it was so clear-cut then. It was so one-sided. As someone, one of the reporters said, well, you're supposed to get two sides of a story, but when the other side is wearing a hood, and, you know, a sheet, it's a little hard to give them equal credit. And so the one-sidedness of it, the clear injustice, the presence of extremely powerful speakers like Martin Luther King and Bob Moses gave it so much more attention. Today, I don't want to say we don't have powerful speakers, but there are a lot of different issues. And I also think the other side on civil rights, if you want to call it that, certainly is not as strong as it was, but it's also much more savvy. And you hear a lot of talk about in the South, I've talked to people about, and not just in the South, codes that there's things you would never, ever, ever say in the press now that you were frequently said in Mississippi in that time. And so it's often said that these days things like voter ID laws are really a code for perhaps restricting or maybe definitely restricting minority voting, whereas in Mississippi or in the South in 64, it was a poll tax. That was not coded. That was clearly an injustice. Now, on the other subject, yes, Ronald Reagan did, in fact, declare not his reelection, but his initial election campaign in 1980 in Philadelphia, Mississippi. And I have to think that wasn't very coded. That was clearly that was chosen because it was a symbol of Southern rebellion and the murder of these three men. And I can't imagine that he didn't know that. So you can make of that what you will, I guess. It should be noted, though, that the Neshoba County Fair every year is a major political event, still is, and it's always been a soapbox for all sorts of political views, or at least as far as come across Mississippi. So it may have been something of just sort of, they call it Mississippi's front porch or something like that. So there was that too, but I don't think Reagan was averse to using that as a symbol.
So 1964, of course, was a presidential election year leading up to both the Republican and Democratic national conventions. Can you talk about what was at stake for Lyndon Johnson, the incumbent president at the time, as the Freedom Summer is going on?
Well, during one of the ways that Freedom Summer really shifted in mid-July was Bob Moses and some others turned their attention to the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City. And their idea was to mount a challenge to Mississippi's all-white delegation. And they did it with what they called the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. It was a parallel party. You didn't have to risk being shot at or cut off your credit cut off if you joined the Freedom Democratic Party, because nobody ever knew. You just signed a paper. They kept signatures. They signed up some 60,000 people. They held their own conventions, elected their own delegation, and got some money from Harry Belafonte and others and sent them by bus to Atlantic City. And they made a highly publicized challenge to Mississippi's all-white delegation. Lyndon Johnson was terrified by this. He foresaw the whole South walking out. Now, he had a huge lead over Barry Goldwater. Nobody really thought the election was up for grabs, but he responded by really shutting that down. And they made a compromise offer of two seats, and the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party talked for hours and rejected it, walked out, went home, and it was really the start of a serious discouragement across the civil rights movement with the legitimate means of political means.
Historian Bruce Watson is my guest. He's author of the book Freedom Summer, which inspired the American Experience documentary Freedom Summer, which will air June 24th on KERA Channel 13 television. If you would like to be part of our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with historian Bruce Watson, author of the 2010 book Freedom Summer, which inspired this year's American Experience documentary of the same name. It will air June 24th on KERA Channel 13 television. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Bruce, if it's not already evident from this discussion, the leadership of SNCC and the other organizations that participated in Freedom Summer was largely African-American. The students, the white students who came to participate and volunteer, understood sort of intellectually that they would have to take their orders from black colleagues, but this sometimes was a source of tension that maybe surprised some of them who had thought themselves to be quite open-minded going into this.
I think the tension was there was some, but when you were interviewed to go down, you were asked to go down to Mississippi. You were asked if that might be a problem for you to take orders or directions from African Americans. One of the other tensions, though, was that came up in black-white was the tension of the locals versus the volunteers, because the local Mississippi folk, SNCC had spent years cultivating them and building up their courage and building up their self-esteem. And then all of a sudden, as someone said, here come these people from Yale and their Triumphs and their MGs, and they're, you know, they're these can-do people. And someone will say, does someone want to make some copies? And a volunteer arm would shoot up, I'll go do it. And the local people just, in many cases, really felt overruled. And a lot of people, for that reason, have wondered whether it was such a good idea, whether that didn't, in fact, set the grassroots movement back quite a bit. And it is an argument to be made.
And certainly the locals all along had had much more to lose.
Absolutely. They were, after all, as it was pointed out, you volunteers, you're going to go home at the end of the summer. We're all going to be here. And there are going to be more repercussions, and indeed there were, for this summer. And once the volunteers left, not all of them left. Some stayed on for another year or two. But once most of them left in the end of August, Mississippi started to go back to its same old ways, and some of the violence, and especially in Macomb and other places, erupted, and it was a rough year after that.
So LBJ, who we talked about in the last segment, is he really sort of stonewalled the Freedom Democratic Party's presence at the Democratic National Convention. On the other hand, he was considered a guiding force in the passage of the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act. How are we to judge him based on these two things that appear to give us different messages about where his sentiments lay?
Boy, it's tough. You hit the paradox right on the head there. He seemed so surprisingly noble and, of course, not surprisingly thoroughly adept at guiding that legislation through the Senate and through Congress. But he didn't look very good during August of 64. He misread the situation terribly, I think. I don't think that it would have been a huge walkout. I think he surely would have won the election anyway if he'd seated the Mississippi Democrats. He just felt like, and I should mention that he made a few comments that were quoted in his phone calls where he said he sympathized with the Freedom Democrats. He said, we can't keep telling these Mississippi whites that, whatever they do, it's okay. These are people, the Freedom Democrats, they were elected in hotels and motels and bars, and they're the essence of democracy, so to speak. But he simply didn't feel he could risk it. So he overreacted, definitely. And even J. Edgar Hoover thought that the bugging that he was asked to do of SNCC offices in Atlantic City was way over the top. So we can't really defend that. But on the other hand, we now have the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, which they're still with us in different forms. And that was LBJ's doing.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Austin on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Austin.
Hi. It's amazing that you opened with that quote by Petey at the beginning of the hour. I was grabbing a hot dog with him last week, and he was talking about, and maybe you could comment on how the white kids who volunteered up north just didn't understand that, they just didn't get the idea that hatred would cause their, quote, that these white guys would kill them just because they were part of the civil rights movement, that it wasn't, this was real. And it was just, that was really eye-opening for me. And if y'all could comment on that, I'll take my intriguing response off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I think that not only were it was a clash of cultures. It was a clash of cultures that no one anticipated. The Klan members who had actually planned to kill Mickey Schwerner even before the Freedom Summer, they hated him. They saw him not just as a intruder, a white liberal, but a Jew. They had targeted him for months, and they didn't have any idea, first of all, that there'd be two other people with him, so it'd be three victims, three bodies, and they really did not see that this would be a national issue. A lot of times when something like that happened in Mississippi, certainly many of the lynchings that had happened over the years, they weren't national news, so they seriously miscalculated. And indeed, the volunteers were not aware, even when SNCC people told them in their training how violent it was likely to be, no one expected it to happen on the first day, and so quickly and so shockingly. I think that really changed Freedom Summer, but again, the story is how people persevered throughout the summer, stayed in the Freedom School, stayed teaching, stayed on the front lines, registering voters and teaching in schools and just living with black people in their shacks. That was, to me, the wonderful spirit of the summer.
And that was also a source of controversy locally, the idea that white women, for example, might board with a black family was scandalous in many parts of Mississippi.
Oh, yes. This was the railroad tracks were a very staunch dividing line between white and black. To some extent, they still are, but nothing like back then, and you might often see in the morning in Mississippi an exodus of black people, women in particular, walking to across town to be maids and whatever, as in the movie The Help, but you never saw it go the other way. Mm. I would not say there were not gestures of kindness between the races, but there was certainly no one would go live, no white person would go live with black people. That was both shocking on a social level and especially on a sexual level, even just the slightest suspicion of white and black together in Mississippi and elsewhere was scandalous.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Jack on the line now in Denton. Hi, Jack.
Good afternoon.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I was just very intrigued with this show. It brought back flashes of memories when my brother and I were growing up and our family would take vacations to Mississippi to visit relatives and to tour historical sites. And it was during the time when Lyndon Johnson was promoting this Voting Rights Act, and about such a obvious clash of cultures and thinking. And even as children, we would spend half of the trip back home discussing how cruel they were to the black people and such a way to treat humankind. And it was so obvious that they literally despised Lyndon Johnson by even just looking at our car tags, and it was almost a gruesome look on their face to ask where we were from in Texas, and my dad would say near Dallas, and they just had disdain in their voice, and that happened in Port Gibson, and my dad quickly decided, we're not staying here tonight, we're leaving Mississippi. So it really brought back some memories from that period of time.
Any comment on that, Bruce?
Well, it was not. Mississippi was embattled, there's no question about it. And one of the reactions that they had, the whole state had, was during the summer of 1964, they had been held up to ridicule throughout the state. There were songs ridiculing. There were people who were, there was all this attention. And Mississippi really became synonymous with the worst part of Jim Crow, and with good reason, as I say. But the reaction was really kind of both a self-analysis that ultimately changed the state, and I do think it's changed, I want to make it clear, quite a bit, enormously. But that began in the summer, but the initial reaction was to hunker down and to look at the entire country with suspicion and to really feel as though they're picking on us. And also a deep denial. There was a long denial for several weeks after the bodies were not found. They said the men were up probably somewhere in the north laughing at us, something like that, total denial. So that was the initial reaction, but I think we have to credit Mississippi with an enormous change, not right away, not for the first decade or two, but with an enormous change over since that time. And I'd hate to anybody to think that was Mississippi and nothing's changed. A lot has changed.
Well, and here's an amazing fact. We said at the top of the hour that before Freedom Summer in 1964, about 6% of the black population was registered to vote in Mississippi. By the end of 1965, that had increased tenfold.
It increased to 60% almost entirely because of the Voting Rights Act, which was passed in 65, but it was put into, they began writing it during Freedom Summer. Then there were two decades of legal battles and different types of gerrymandering and things like that. But today, Mississippi has more elected black officials than any other state. It has black sheriffs, mayors, city council, on and on, not just in Jackson and elsewhere, but in the Delta. And so I am always quick to credit Mississippi for that.
What does Mississippi do with this anniversary? On the one hand, the changes that the state has made should be something that everyone is proud of. On the other hand, it's got to be painful to think of how many changes they needed to make.
I think it's a sore spot in the nation, a blot on the state's history. And but they've done it. And someone, when they saw my book, I heard said, "Oh, that again." And I'm not too surprised because it's come up over and over periodically, generationally. But they've done a very good job of dealing with it. I do believe there will be several Freedom Summer 50th anniversary events starting This week I'm going down to Mississippi in a couple of days to speak to school groups, and there's always this Saturday there will be in Meridian, Mississippi, the annual Mississippi Martyrs Memorial March in honor of Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney. This will be the 50th one. And the week out, and starting next Monday, there's a whole conference of volunteers and others coming in, so there'll be a lot of events. There's going to be a lot of pride.
It's got to be remarkable as a historian to work with a period of time from which there are still people alive today that you can talk to. And I wonder about the difference between sort of going back through the records as compared with interviewing a living witness.
It is both wonderful and tricky because human memory is wonderful and tricky. Mm-hmm. And I met people who didn't really remember a lot of it. Most everybody, if you think back 50 years, if you have that time frame, what do you remember from 50 years ago? Even something as pivotal as this in your life, you develop three or four or a handful of stories that you tell over and over again. And getting people to go deeper than that was sometimes difficult, but I was lucky to find four volunteers who had many, many memories. They had letters that they had written from Mississippi, newspaper clippings of themselves. So I was lucky to find some of those, as well as tapping the other memories of a wide variety of people.
Economic injustice is still an issue in Mississippi, or I should say poverty is an issue in Mississippi. Does that contribute to whatever remains of the state's problems with racism?
I think economic injustice is a problem in America, but there is a starker line in Mississippi there because it still remains America's poorest state. I suppose that does contribute, and yet I'm not sure. I'm not absolutely sure of that. I know that I see when I go to Mississippi every time people, black and white, relating in a way that I don't see here in my native New England. I can't say that we're staunchly segregated here in New England, but I live in Massachusetts. But there's a lot more interaction at diners, at hotels, at just on the street, friends, genuine friendships, I believe. And I would be naive if I didn't say that there is clearly some racism in Mississippi, of course, as throughout the country. But I also think Martin Luther King once said that if and when the South ever integrated, it would do it better than the North because black and white had lived together for so long. And I think he was pretty wise.
Historian Bruce Watson is the author of the 2010 book Freedom Summer that inspired the new American Experience documentary of the same name. Freedom Summer airs June 24th on KERA Channel 13 television. Bruce, it's been a very interesting hour. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. We had help today from Christina Ulsh on the phones. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.